And we're off. Welcome to Silicon Curtain. This is going to be a special episode with Jonathan Pierce and Greg Terry. We've all been together on the channel before, but I think we are going to be a little more combative in this episode. We're going to talk about the persecution of religion, not in Ukraine, but by Russia in the occupied territories. We're going to talk about how religion is going to be weaponized or is being weaponized as part of the US election. And we're going to talk about the hard choice people have, those who are pro-Ukrainian, the hard choice in the forthcoming election between one group, the Biden camp, who are now quite clearly appeasing Russia. They fear Russia and they fear the nuclear threat from Russia. And we have Trump. And we're going to try to talk about or imagine what a Trump presidency would mean for Ukraine. Welcome to the conversation, Greg and Jonathan.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jonathan. So from here forward, I will refer to Jonathan as Jonathan Fink and JP as Jonathan Pierce.
Let's do that. I'm sure it'll get confusing, but the edit will sort everything else out, I'm sure. Well, let's start with religious persecution, because I think this is something you can both talk to. And I did a powerful episode the other day with DW Phillips, and it was on the persecution of evangelical minorities, on Baptists, Protestants, in fact, anyone who didn't conform to Russian Orthodoxy that is governed at this point by Patriarch Kirill, who was a KGB officer and is certainly part of the Russian, I would say, security infrastructure to this day. Greg, let's start with you. Persecution, is it real? And is it happening on the Ukrainian side? No, the Russian side rather than the Ukrainian side.
100%. I have firsthand witness and testimony from two of my dear friends. One from southern Ukraine, occupied from the city of Melitopol, was kidnapped for 9 days, interrogated, mildly tortured. I want to always tell the truth, beaten. And 9 days later, he was able to be released. And then he had to escape by going into Russia, wrapping around, and he is now safely back in the unoccupied portion of Ukraine. So that's fact one. He's a Protestant evangelical pastor. Now, I can also take it back. Instead of 2024, we can go all the way back to 2016. 2016, a dear friend of mine, I was in Donetsk when it was occupied myself. And I came out, and that's before it really heated up. I was on actually one of the last flights into the Donetsk airport before that all went to pot. And I was in Donetsk. I got out. My pastor buddy stayed. He was doing some other meetings. We had no idea the level of what was really happening, to be honest, there in 2016. I get back to my apartment in Western Ukraine. I get a call from his family and says, "Have you heard from John Doe?" And I said, "He's still in Donetsk." They go, "He's been taken." And he was held for 72 hours and beaten extremely, to an extreme level. He is still an evangelical pastor in Western Ukraine. He, interesting enough, was a former officer in the Soviet Army way back when, stationed in East Berlin. And they were just hunting for information. They were going through the phones, they were going through the contacts, even that far back. So just imagine what's happened today. Now, any persecution on the Ukrainian side, part two of your question, absolutely not. Zero. I am in Ukraine nonstop. JP was just there with me. I'm sure he can testify that he saw nothing. I can tell you the only persecution comes in the occupied territory.
I think the Russians have just got very good form in using tools to get their own ends, I guess, And they will get into bed domestically with the interesting, given where the Soviet Union has come from and state atheism. I say this as an atheist philosopher of religion, but, you know, I believe in secularism and separation of church and faith and, you know, freedom to think these things and et cetera, et cetera. I won't go down any of those rabbit holes. But, you know, Russia has an interesting relationship with the church. At different times in Soviet history, it's kind of used the church. There's a very much an involvement of the KGB with the Soviet era church, or Russian Orthodox Church, to the point where the present patriarch Kirill is a former KGB agent, and so they use that as a vehicle in many different ways. The moment, well, for the last decade or so, we have had Putin using the church to try and manipulate, I think, the population, try and conform them into a sense of what he wants, a more conformist, easily identifiable, malleable single mass, rather than lots of liberal people going off and doing what they want, having their own ideas. He's using traditional values and the Russian Orthodox Church to obtain a pliable population to a much greater extent. And then going into Ukraine, I think it is the same sort of thing, but then you've got also war taking place, and you have their propensity to pretty much torture anyone they capture, whether they are members of, you know, men of cloth or not. And so it is completely unsurprising that the Russians would be persecuting Christian groups, or other, not just Christian groups, other religious groups within the occupied territories. And the Ukrainians would have no reason to do that in their own country. You know, the rest of Ukraine is just Ukraine getting on with trying to be the country of Ukraine. Like, they have no need to persecute religious groups while they're at war with another country. And so I think it's ridiculous. And we can go on in a minute to talk about what Marjorie Taylor Greene has recently said with regard to, you know, persecution of Christians within Ukraine.
And there is a problematic question. Again, we'll go to Craig and then you, Jonathan. And that is the issue of the Russian Orthodox Church under the Moscow Patriarch that is existing on the territory of Ukraine. This has become a political issue. This is the thing that really, you know, as we're going to talk about later, is being weaponized in GOP propaganda. But it's a genuine problem for the Ukrainian government because, you know, the Russian Orthodox Church very much is used as a spy network. Mm. It's used as a tool of coercion. And there are implications that it has been used in territories that are about to be occupied or recently occupied to basically give information to the Russian security forces that then may have led to people being arrested, abducted, tortured, disappeared, and so on. So there's some deeply problematic things going on here, and why it's so important, I think, to understand what the Russian Orthodox Church is as an entity, and it's, you know, spiritualism is perhaps not its prime purpose.
Well, let me share this with you. First of all, there are many, many, many verified infiltrations of the Russian Orthodox Church that have, whether it's marked locations, past information during this phase of the war since the full-scale invasion in February of 2022. Those are facts. That's easy. Whether it's in Lviv, Kyiv, Odessa, doesn't matter. It happens. But I want to interject something in here now that people may not realize, and that is this. There is a reverential fear of the Orthodox Church within Russia and within Ukraine. They're just due to decades and decades and decades and decades of the power of that cloth, the power of that institution, the power of that, for example, the priest of the local church there, wherever it may be, there is, I believe my word's accurate, there's just a fear, not a healthy fear, but a fear of, because to be quite honest, I've spent a lot of time in Russia, and actual Russian Orthodoxy, yes, you've talked about it being an avenue of the FSB. You've talked about Kirill. We know that they are being used to stand behind Putin and to represent the work of the Kremlin before the people behind them as this beautiful, holy war. And we are the only Christians in the world, and we stand for what is right. And look what's happening in the United States with the LGBTQA, all of these movements. Look at what's happening in Europe. We are the only Christians. That's what they do. But I'm telling you right now, it's all a front. It's all a sham. And a lot of Russian orthodoxy is actually mixed. And now I'm the evangelical Christian pastor in this group. It's mixed with so many things that are not biblically based. It is with full of superstition. It is full of historical layers of what they have added to their cult, to be quite honest. And now that is being weaponized against the world. So yes, it's a very, very dangerous institution that not only has outreach in Ukraine, guys, and Russia, of course, but globally. They have little dots and tentacles all throughout this globe.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I think today, I reported on it today anyway in one of my videos, that Estonia is now discussing whether to designate the Russian Orthodox Church as a terrorist organization. Mm-hmm. So that's how they understand the role that the Russian Orthodox Church plays in the geopolitical scene. I mean, it is an entity that is far more, I guess, insidious than a simple church organization, right? And so I think that's quite representative of maybe where the Orthodox Church is. Russian Orthodox Church.
And is it possible to characterize the Russian Church? And this may not be a label that only applies to this entity in history. It could perhaps be used to other points in history for other organizations, but is it essentially an imperial structure? Is it an imperial church? A sort of, you know, you're either with us or against us kind of church? Because that sort of, I would say, aggressive undertone there, that sort of purpose to coerce and to occupy and to take over. I mean, that very much is the characteristic of the Russian state. If the church is working hand in hand with the Russian state, then it, you know, it could perhaps be labeled as an imperial institution. And we see from the recent announcements of Patriarch Kirill announcing holy war. I mean, this is taking it into territory, surely, of ISIS. You know, some mm-hmm. of the recent pronouncements that we've seen in his sort of speeches and writings.
I can tell you from experience. Let me just answer this and go to you, JP. I can tell you from experience, in Russia, they are the only church in their minds. Now, are there other churches in Russia? Yes, I've been to many of them. Evangelicals, Pentecostals, Baptists, Presbyterians. I've been to all of them personally. And the pressure that's always applied governmentally on those churches, whether it be infrastructure, maybe trying to land a building or get a place to meet, they go through torture. They go through red tape nonstop. And that, honestly, is the work of the tentacles of the Orthodox Church standing against them. So yes, they think they're the only way. Now, in contrast to that, the Ukrainian Orthodox Church is 100% opposite. I have personally stood arm in arm with the Orthodox priest, and we stand for the same thing, standing for right values, standing for what we believe and hold to be truth in our own hearts. There's no behind the scenes workings, that we're not the only voice. We stand together with others who have like faith and maybe choose a different highway to go for that. So it's quite complex, but for sure, Russian Orthodox Church is, they're the only show in town.
Yeah, all I was going to add is that kind of rhetoric about, you know, holy war isn't unusual, as in you would expect a leader to do that, because you're trying to, you know, justify to your people a war that might otherwise be incredibly unpopular, and so you use all the tools you can. But Bush did this with the crusade into Iraq and the war against terror and so on and so forth. It was a crusade, right? And so it's bringing those people along with you. So I do understand why he would do that, and it's not surprising. I doubt he sees it actually as a holy war, but we do. It's incredible. We do see Russian Orthodox priests all over the shop. Spraying holy water on tanks as they go past, on trains. We've seen them in the Orenburg and Orsk region of Russia recently, in planes going above like dams and stuff, and because all the flooding that's taking place. So Russia just culturally is going through a very interesting move from state atheism into like really embracing religiosity. However, when you look at the stats of Russian religiosity, they are actually not very religious as a nation. When you look at church attendance, when you look at other metrics for measuring religiosity, it doesn't measure up to them being this great holy nation that someone like Putin will be claiming. And that's because Russia is just always this paper tiger, Potemkin village, whatever you want to call it. There's so much disinformation and so many veneers that they put on stuff that trying to work out what the reality is very difficult. And I think that leads me on to, but I'll let you guys speak for a bit, which is where some Americans see Russian supposed religiosity, and then why you start getting certain politico-religious types in America having favorable views of Putin and Russia due to the seemingly religious nature of Russia.
I'll ask one more question about the nature of Orthodoxy, and then we'll start making that connection with propaganda. And this is a kind of a link question, because what's the primary objective of the Russian Orthodox Church? Is it power, status, and projecting a certain kind of image? Because, I watch, unfortunately, a lot of Russian propagandists in the original, and they have a huge range. And this isn't just one or two that people may have heard of. There are many, many dozens of them. And some, they're all spouting genocidal rhetoric. Some are worse than others. Some of the most vindictive and unpleasant genocidal rhetoric is actually on the church-run state channel and is uttered by priests, Orthodox priests. There are a number of them who appear regularly in the propagandistic broadcasts and have done so since 2014 at least. So what's the prime objective? Is it to, guard people's souls, or is it to control their minds?
It is more to control their minds, I promise you, than to guard their souls. And let me explain to you why. If we were in, Jonathan, you will understand this. When you go to an Orthodox, let's just think in basic simple. I'm an Orthodox Christian. On Sunday, I go to the temple and I have a church service and I worship God. Well, in the homily there, when the patriarch or the priest comes out, they actually deliver their message in ancient Russian text, and it is actually unintelligible for 90% plus of speakers or attenders of the service. So we're definitely not there guarding your soul. What we're trying to do is validate that we are the voice of God, because we understand and you do not. Therefore, do as we say, not as we do. Now, so definitely, there is an agenda there to further the work of the Kremlin. That's a fact, guys, period. But think about this for a second. I'm looking it up right now. In the Russian Orthodox Church, 40,514 full-time clerics, 35,677 presbyters, and 4,837 deacons, 38,649 parishes as of 2019, 314 dioceses 2019, 972 monasteries. Think about that for a moment. The reach and the amount of information that can get down to listen to who? I hope I say this the right way. To the common man, to the common person. that is attending that. I mean, the rhetoric now, and Jonathan, I know you understand Russian, the rhetoric now that comes out of many of these parishes is we are God's warriors. We are vindicators of what is truth, and we are righteous in our killing of Ukrainians. And this is the hate that they spread, to be quite honest, every day. So this is a big, big, big-headed monster we're dealing with that most of the world is clueless about, especially the American church.
I don't know. It's a whole kind of religion is the opiate of the masses. And some people say religion was, you know, created or designed or in order to control the masses. And I always pull people up on that. It's like, no, but it's just a tool that can be appropriated very easily because we all have in-group, out-group psychologies, right? And you know, whether it's a football team, you're a football club and you hate your derby opposition or whatever in your local area. Well, when it comes to a church, then that can manifest in very much a tribal feeling. And so therefore, it's really easy to co-opt that and say, right, this is a holy war and we're going against these people. And it's almost like, well, everyone else is therefore, by extension, a heathen. And therefore, you can start dehumanizing them and they're all going to go to hell anyway. So there are all sorts of ways psychologically that religion can end up allowing you, if you're a government that wants to use religion, there are so many ways you could effectively use it genocidally. I'm absolutely sure. And that's not to, so I'm not trying to speak to the truth or falsity of any kind of religious claims. It's just, it's ripe for being able to be co-opted. And I think that's what happens a lot. And a lot has to be said about in-group, out-group psychology. And it's interesting what Greg says about, you know, the language being used in certain Orthodox religious ceremonies. That's because, well, it just reminds me of like Catholicism moving through into, you know, when you had the attempt to try and get English, you know, vernacular Bibles written. Mm-hmm. And before that, it was like the people that could speak the language could control what you understood of reality. And that was just, again, ripe for a situation that's ripe for controlling other people, and you know, if they don't understand, then you get to say, right, I as a priest can now dictate to you what I think you should be doing, etc., etc. And I don't know. I just think that it's an unhealthy relationship between the Kremlin and the Russian Orthodox Church, and I don't think either institutions are particularly morally upstanding.
Well, let's get on to the subject of manipulation and weaponization, because what we see extremely prominently happening now and in the run-up to what is the critical election process in the US, we now see a huge uptick in stories, some of them absolute nonsense. For instance, the ones peddled by Marjorie Taylor Greene that actually Christians are persecuted in Ukraine. I think we've decisively, you know, countered that, so there's no reality behind that. But how do these narratives get warped and changed and amplified for these political lens? And I'd love to know from Greg what the penetration of these stories actually is amongst people who are, you know, genuine believers in the US, and how dangerous that these lies are being drip fed. Well, it's not even a drip feed anymore. It's a sort of fire hose of nonsense that is now being, absolutely pumped into the US system ahead of the election.
Such an interesting question, and my honor to answer it. I don't even know where to begin, to be quite honest, with that question, but I can tell you this. Unfortunately, my country, and I am an ordained minister of the gospel for 30 years. I travel throughout this entire country, all the states. I work in 38 nations doing this. I am so ashamed of my country. I am ashamed of the Christians in my country, not all, but the ones who have chosen the easy way out. And that is, if this person says it, then it must be true. And it doesn't, this is not just, for example, Marjorie Taylor Greene, Donald J. Trump. This even comes down to denominational levels, pastors of local churches. I'm sorry, guys, but televangelists who have swallowed all of the lies and the venom of the Donald Trump MAGA cult, which for the most part are lies. Not everything, okay, but for the most part are lies. And what happens is there is such an influence from pastors, televangelists, prophets, evangelists, teachers, that people have become lemmings. They do not choose to research on their own. They do not choose to read on their own. Basically, a majority of the church, the Christian right in America, has been dumbed down. And I am in that group. I'm Christian right. Dumbed down, and they believe whatever they are spoon-fed. Here is a firsthand example. Firsthand, I was speaking in Carson City, Nevada, at a large church. And I had just returned from one of my frontline runs there helping Ukraine. At that point, 25 years working in Ukraine, about a year ago. I'm speaking at this church, and when the church service is over, they actually take a large offering to help the work in Ukraine. I mean, wonderful, caring, everything's beautiful. And a friend of mine who has been in that church forever, whom I've actually known for over 2 decades, walked up to me and they said, "Greg, we are so proud of you." I said, "Well, thank you. What are you proud of? Your work in Ukraine, you risking your life to go to the front lines, you're helping people, you're sharing the gospel, you're doing all of these things, you're being a good example. We're just proud of you. We're happy to support your work. But Greg, please be careful, because Ukraine is corrupt and Ukraine are Nazis and Zelensky is the Antichrist. Now, what you're doing there is wonderful and we will continue to support you. But when it comes to the truth with the political scene and the national scene, you're completely wrong. They really are Nazis, but we love you. Keep doing a good job." Brother, that is basically a verbatim quote to me. And I said, "Okay, 25 years working there. I speak the language. You've known me for 2 decades and you think I don't know what's going on in Ukraine?" They said, No. You understand Ukraine, but listen, you don't have information that Donald Trump has. You don't have information that these people have." I said, no, I'm just there inside. Okay. "No, we love you, but you're wrong on this. They really are corrupt and they need to be destroyed. That government, not the people, that government." This is what I deal with nonstop. So there is your firsthand example of what happens in the United States due to my opinion of people not taking the time to research, to learn, to figure it out themselves, because it's much easier just to listen to basically the second coming of Jesus, Donald Trump, in their minds. Is that fairly stated for you, JP? That's
absolutely fascinating. I've heard you told me that before, and it's yes. There's so much I want to talk to you about that. We've got many conversations to have. But what I wanted to talk about, and it'd be interesting to get your view on this, Greg, is that from my point of view, and having written a long time on the separation of church and state and American politics and secularism in the US and the trouble with it being technically a secular nation, but really a religious nation. So it's a far more religious nation than UK. But it's a secular nation. The UK is not a secular nation. We've got the Queen as a head of state and head of the Church of England. And we are basically religious. We have religious antipathy here. So we're like, yeah, whatever. I think it's a really interesting situation in the US. But there, it has long been this idea, especially as religion is becoming less and less prevalent across society, demographically, statistically speaking, it's starting to fight back more. It's like when you, it's not the, at this stage, but when you put, when you, you've got an injured caged animal or something in a corner, it's going to fight back harder. And I think there is this, there's been this understanding that, that religion, many religious people have presented this idea that they're being persecuted. And you have this grievance narrative with many people on the religious right, particularly in America, that Christianity is being persecuted without realizing that it has a massively privileged status in the US in terms of tax exemption, has a massively privileged state in the in Congress where no one it has the guts to say they're openly atheist. Like the if you look at the statistics of the belief of lawmakers compared to the general population, it doesn't track. It just so happens that almost all lawmakers are Christian because they have to say that because otherwise they won't get voted in. And so therefore there's this idea from many in the base that or the general population that Christianity is being persecuted, and yet the reality that doesn't track at all. But that persecution narrative then can get confined purchase when they then are told by people like Marjorie Taylor Greene that Christians are being persecuted in Ukraine by the Ukrainians, in occupied Ukraine, by the Ukrainians, not by the Russians. And then that brings loads of bells with the certain people in certain demographics that then go, oh, yeah, I get that, Marjorie Taylor Greene. And of course, she's just regurgitating absolute, like, full-on one-to-one Russian propaganda, but it finds a purchase with these people that for which it's fertile, you know, they are fertile territory for those seeds that are dropping down. And I think that is a real problem. And there's so much we can talk about with regard to, you know, the religious demography of the US and how that, I think when they start looking at Putin, and you're starting to see now people on the religious right openly say, being interviewed at Trump rallies, saying, I would rather vote for Putin than for Biden if Putin was running in the US elections. You're like that's literally been caught on camera a number of times. And you're saying, because Putin is talking hard about traditional values and about religious conservatism, that rings bells. And they're saying, right, I feel Christianity is being persecuted. Here's someone that's standing up for religious conservatism and traditional values. I think America's going to hell in a handcart. Look at all these gay people going around, and look at all this terrible stuff that's going on there. And here's someone that's standing up for that. And they can almost differentiate, and the statistics have now shown that people are actually starting to differentiate Putin from the Russian war machine. And so that there are some people that are saying, although I disagree with what's going on with the Russian war effort, I still think Putin is a great guy. And that's like some fascinating statistics that's coming out. And that's all because it's like checkbox. And he will know that. And so he will be riding high. He'll be riding the wave of religious conservatism because he knows that that will get him a lot of support from the US electorate, who will then vote in the person who he wants, which is Donald Trump.
Correct. One of the interesting. Over to you.
Let me just interject here. So just for you guys to consider, I know you guys are in the UK, I'm here in the US. First of all, there is very little to no news on the war in Ukraine anymore on our televisions, period. Okay, basically zero. And the news that is fed through social media. And for example, just for one talking point here, Putin says the right phrases, and then those that have the reach, those that have the system in place, push those talking narratives through, such as, we stand for Christianity. Let's just leave it there. We stand for Christianity. That is taken, it is pushed, and all they need is that phrase. And it is digested through a network of Christians and churches, which, by the way, is on the decline in the United States. You are 100% correct, but it is pushed. And then that talking point and that narrative becomes the only fact that is needed. This is why there's nothing to counteract it, nothing other than us.
And it's made more challenging because humans aren't very good at doing nuance, right? We like simplicity, good versus evil, black and white. You know, the great Adam Curtis, who's a BBC documentary maker, has done a lot of documentaries. A great one, The Power of Nightmares, looks at the war on terror and the fact that it was really nuanced when we went to Afghanistan. And actually, there was all sorts of stuff going on, and it wasn't. We were trying to sell it as good and evil, and of course that was counterproductive in the end. But the problem is that humans just love that. We love that simplicity. And when we look at difficult wars like Gaza and Israel, like, we can't handle the fact that it's freaking nuanced. And then when you look at even though I think the Ukraine Russia war is the simplest, clearest moral evaluation of any conflict in recent history or possibly ever, there are still many nuances that surround it, and that there are many messages that, as Greg just talked about, that are coming out of it that land with people, and they go, right, okay, pro-Christian, right, that's good, that's me done, I now know who I support. And that's terribly simplistic, but that's, unfortunately, humans, happier humans are the humans that are more certain in their conclusions, and the more nuance we get and the more kind of we become, actually statistics show, you know, research shows that leads to being less happy. And so it's understandable why people err towards simplicity and certitude in that simplicity.
And the question that leads from that, I think this is quite a broad one, and it will take us into the election conversation, and that is the conflation between politics and belief and how dangerous it is. Because if you look at this on the surface, you have Biden, who, rather than just putting on a label, Jonathan said a minute ago, that all candidates have to profess belief, and it's extremely risky to come out and do the opposite. But Biden genuinely seems to be a devout Catholic. He genuinely seems to be a family man, with, I would say, you know, traditional values. He seems to be a deeply religious kind of person. So at what point did religiosity becomes so conflated with politics that people who oppose Biden see him as a version of the Antichrist? I mean, at what point did religion become so kind of entrenched and polarized that people are willing to demonize anything that doesn't sort of, you know, think the same way the way they do, vote the same the way they do, etc.?
I think Greg can talk more eloquently about this, but you've got to understand the position Catholicism plays within the partisan dynamics of the American electorate. You've got to go back to JFK. So it's interesting that even him saying, I'm a devout Catholic, is not the same as saying I'm a devout Christian, because that will play well with certain people in certain demographics, and other people there be like, oh, Catholic, whereas I'm an evangelical Protestant or something like that. And like it or not, even those kind of labels have political dimensions.
Jonathan, this is on your channel, so do you want me to go there or not?
Depends how much detail, really. The other question,
this is your question very simply.
Yes.
But I will need to touch a little bit of biblical theology, if it's okay.
Please go ahead. Yeah.
Okay. I want to be respectful to you, dear sir. JP, I'm not so concerned about, but for Jonathan, I definitely want to be respectful. First of all, you said, sitting in the UK there, it seems he's a devout. Okay. For me, it seems he is not. Okay. And JP went there. Now, I will equally say, please hear me. You see, for example, the Twitter, the tweets, the Facebooks, where Donald Trump is in the evangelical church, clapping his hands, giving
doesn't know any of the words to the prayers and stuff, but yep.
Favorite Bible verse, 2 Corinthians.
Listen, it seems he's a Christian. First of all, Joe Biden is much more Christian than Donald Trump ever is. Donald Trump is a narcissist.
Indeed, yeah.
Okay, we'll leave that there. But in the United States, Catholicism is not viewed as Christian by the general public. And I know that's for a different program and a different time. So the Christian church in the United States, whether it's just straight along evangelical, Baptist, Protestant, a Presbyterian, Episcopalian, Lutheran, you name it, keep going down the line. They believe that, like I believe, that salvation comes through accepting Christ as your Savior and repenting of your sins. Bible 101. Now, the view of the Christian church that I just described is the Catholics do not work that way. It works through Mary. It works through the ordinances of the church versus a personal relationship with the Son of God. So therein is the differentiation in the United States. I'm just answering it for you. So these millions and millions and millions and millions of evangelicals look at the Catholic Church and go, oh, well, he's a Catholic. Oh, he's pro-abortion.
Exactly. Yeah.
He's a murderer.
Yeah, which is actually not a Catholic thing. So Catholics are usually very strongly, you know, anti-abortion, but there's an interesting
correct. So you have all these nuances. So I know that it's much more complicated than just it seems he's a Christian. This is a very deep-hearted issue, especially in the demographics of people that are above the age of 50, at 50 to 80, where the purse strings are, where the ingrained, entrenched America of the 60s and the 70s and the 80s, where everybody went to church on Sunday and everybody went to church on Wednesday. And now we live in basically the initiation of a post-Christian culture here in the United States. And that demographic between 50 and 80, their minds are blown. They have no clue what to do, so they just go with the party line. Biden's evil. At least Trump went to church. I saw it on Facebook. That's it, guys. It's not more complicated than that here in the U.S.
So it's easy. It's easy for people actually to align their political sensibilities, as it were, with the religious ones. It's actually quite a clean process of people to take advantage of.
To come in there though, like I think it has changed. So I don't know the stats, but I think Catholics would have previously associated more with Democrats. But I think it has changed. So I think white Catholics are now 61% GOP leaning, which is interesting. But Hispanic Catholics are 60% Democrat leaning. So again, you've got a racial ethnic dimension there as well. But I think that's interesting that you might have seen a change over time, and that might have to do with how some forms of Catholicism have become maybe more evangelical in their nature. When you've looked at things like abortion and how that's been kind of weaponized in terms of politically weaponized. So I think I think the end result is it's really nuanced, and the point is to say that Biden is Catholic it doesn't necessarily mean to say he's Christian in the sense that he's therefore he will appeal to all American Christians.
From the general American viewpoint, when you say Biden is Catholic, you're not speaking to anybody in the Christian right. They could care less.
Yeah.
And, you know, my upbringing, again, when I went to school, I went to church twice a week, Wednesdays and Saturdays. And, I my position here. I'm with Jonathan there.
Yes.
But I did try to tune into the words, and I tried to listen to the words, and some of them didn't talk to me in any sense whatsoever because, you know, I felt them to be sort of ritualistic and, dare I say it, mind control. Some of the stories are really fascinating. And one of the ones that I tried to imagine because, you know, that must if it happened in the way it's written, then it must have been an extraordinary scene, which was expelling the money changers from the temple. That must have been. I mean, you think of the might of the Roman Empire. You think of what's kind of going on there. You also read about, let's say, the position of how many churches were used, let's say, in the late Middle Ages or even during the English Civil War. You know, in Britain, you had the king's troops stabling their horses in Westminster Cathedral. This is before the Great Fire of London. I mean, you imagine the scene. You had people trading, you know, meat and fish and so on, and conducting markets, and almost beyond what we can imagine. So quite interesting historically to imagine this. But because I was brought up in a very sort of, you know, proper school. I associate, you know, Christianity with good taste, let's say, you know, beautifully rendered churches, nice tasteful songs, people well dressed, you know. I mean, it's all very clean. Yes, it's all very clean and kind of
the Church
nice.
Of England, Church of England religiosity is such a far cry from like evangelical fundamentalism.
You very know, singing, genteel.
Singing these dirges on a Sunday and like, you know.
But that, so this jars in my mind, and instantly, you know, it creates this sense of grifting, is the idea that someone who last week was selling gold-plated trainers to raise money for his legal fees, this week is selling Bibles. Just that sort of image immediately screams grift to me. But the question for Greg is, I'm assuming that other people, that doesn't sort of, you know, press their buttons, it doesn't trigger them in the same way that it triggers me.
Thank you for asking this question.
It triggers him, I can tell you. I know this.
Thank you for asking this question. Because I'm surprising your viewers and your guys with some of my viewpoints here. That has been swallowed by many of that ultra-conservative, nationalistic Christian movement that is a cancer in our country right now as an act of God. But let me tell you something, dear people. That is pure evil. It is a grift. And I'm going to tell you why it's evil. First of all, we're going to have the American Bible. We're going to have the Trump Bible. Okay, listen to me closely. God is not an American. And God is not some white guy on a throne with a white beard hovering in heaven. Period. I believe God is a spirit according to the scripture. Now, the scripture also says, do not add one dot, tittle, letter to the word of God. And then these grifters led by Donald Trump go and put into the Bible the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence. Hello, that's not in the Bible. The Bible is the word of God, and leave it for what it is and don't use it to further your agenda to suck people down your toilet bowl. Sorry, you hit my button and JP knew it was coming.
I knew that was coming, and I loved
listening
to it.
It's pure evil. It's pure evil, Jonathan. A lot of my type Christian conservatives in America. For example, I can tell you right now, Darren Gurdes, it's pure evil for him because this is not Christianity. That's evil. Sorry.
And back to the Bible story, you know, in that scenario, in the Bible story, these people would have been cleaned out. They would have been shoved out onto the street and ejected, right?
But actually,
would have beat the snot out of Donald Trump. Telling you, Jesus would have beat the snot out of him.
Thing is, you get all these different movements. So prosperity gospel, which means that there's a Christianity for every type of person. So if you love slavery, there's a Christianity for you. If you hate slavery, there's a Christianity for you. Literally, the abolitionists and the slave traders were both Christians fighting and using the Bible to justify their position. So if you love money, if you hate money, if you loved it. So, you know, it's all about interpretation. Of course it is. That's what humans will do whenever you get any kind of document or anything like that. You can talk about that in terms of the SCOTUS with the Constitution, right? It's about interpreting that document and apply and making moral laws out of it. Well, actually, it's the same for how Christians will take the Bible and interpret that to make moral laws out of it. And so, you know, you will get people who will find that kind of grift. Televangelists, you know, people who televangelists appeal to will be fine with Donald Trump doing that. When Donald Trump got in 2016, I wrote a bunch of articles saying, well, hang on, like, do you not know the sort of human being Donald Trump is? He's just literally advocated sexual assault with the whole, you know, that hot mic tape and whatnot, and then he's been married three times, and then you blah 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 blah. You know, you used to be the moral majority that said, well, we're going to be, you know, we want to be doing politics in line with our sense of morality. It's like you've just thrown that off straight away and embraced Trump, and So I think for a lot of people, and there's still talk about this now, which is how is he still holding on to these evangelical voters given his track record? And it's because it's a means to an end. They can forgive an awful lot if it's like, if you're going to get me abortion bans nationwide, and if you're going to get me able to shoot my gun and you know, get rid of gun control. And it's, people are predominantly single issue voters and will forgive all sorts of evils in order to get the one thing that really talks to them, whether that's, you know, religious freedom or you know, whatever it is, as I say, guns and abortion or whatever. And so I think that kind of explains why an awful lot of people have these uncomfortable relationships with Trump. And then it becomes a case of post hoc rationalization, which is after the fact rationalization, which is, okay, I want to vote for this guy because of guns or because of this or that. And then I have to go and do mental gymnastics in order to explain all these other aspects of Donald Trump, which are clearly bonkers. And then there's all sorts of what's called cognitive dissonance reduction and sort of mental gymnastics and heuristics that allow them to keep hold of this entity that is Donald Trump, because we don't do nuance well. Like we said before, it's all or nothing. So everything about Donald Trump has to be right because he's this idol that we have. He's this cult leader. He's this almost God. And it's the same with Elon Musk. It's the same with all these sorts of people. Is unfortunately, their followers generally can't do nuance, which is like, he's good over here, but over there he sucks. So with Donald Trump, it's like, he's amazing at everything, but then I have to do all sorts of mental stuff to allow for that.
This leads us into, I think, the final area, which is then the choice facing people in the upcoming election. We have a fire hose of Kremlin lies that are entering into this election debate. We have a lot of news media that are repeating and amplifying those lies. We have a lack of true storytelling about Ukraine. And then on the other hand, we have Biden, who, we're going to put it out there, this is a choice between Biden and his team, who seem genuinely to be afraid of Russia's threats, afraid of nuclear threat, and their policies have descended from as long as it takes to as long as we can. And now we're at the point where, as long as it doesn't upset Russia too much, this is where we're at the moment. And let's put a label on it. We've got a choice between appeasement of Putin and collaboration with Putin on the Trump side. Is that how you see the choice before voters? First over to Greg.
Jonathan, yes, in your description there, it was very accurate. Appeasement of Putin or cooperation with Putin, both guys are bad. They're not the best options. I just have to say here, you know, this is being recorded in early April of 2024. I will tell both of you fellows right now that I am in turmoil for November. I cannot vote for Donald Trump. I cannot vote for Joe Biden. I also have enough understanding to know that a no vote is a vote. I understand the complexities of math, but I personally believe that come November, we're going to be in a much different world than we are in now. And I personally believe that there is a possibility that the candidates we are discussing here in early April will not be the candidates in November, just through procedural things that are happening. We are still a little way out. So I am never, I'm not an evil person. I'm not wishing ill will on Donald Trump. I'm not wishing ill will on Joe Biden. But for me personally, I couldn't vote for Joe because, well, he has a good team around him. You have to understand, I think his team is horrible. I think if Joe Biden perished and Kamala Harris became president, then guys, we're in real trouble. But that is my viewpoint, and doesn't mean it's right. It's just my opinion. With that said, I'm just holding the line right now with patience, not trying to get so out of whack knowing that this world that we're living in early April, is not the same world we will be voting in come November. And that's not a doom. That's not a fatalist. That's just the way the world is changing so quickly. And I personally believe as an American that many people will make their decision the moment they walk in the booth, that very second. Because to be honest, at this point, that is where Greg will make his decision that second. And I'm just hoping, so we can have hopium here. I'm hoping the landscape changes because back to your question, I do not like either option.
Neither option is good for Ukraine, I'm assuming.
Have we got an hour? Because this question deserves an hour. Right. So my opinion would be that Greg, I think, should vote for Joe Biden. He's probably expecting me to say that. And someone else said it recently. They were talking about this in pretty similar terms. And they were saying, I'd definitely vote weak over evil every day of the week, which is...
I'm sorry, may I ask you one question?
Yeah, sure.
Please be, and you always are, please be honest with me. This has nothing to do with personalities or politics or anything.
Oh, yeah.
Let me just ask you a question. 1 second.
Yeah.
Do you think... Let me preface it one more time. This is not about Twitter. This is not about memes. This is not about Facebook videos. This is just about direct observation with the brilliant brain power you have. Do you think Joe Biden is cognitively prepared to lead the United States and lead the world right now?
Yes. I actually do.
We have to disagree.
Yeah, so I've seen some analyses on this, and it's interesting. So Joe Biden has an aging brain, and what he's doing at the moment, as far as his brain is concerned, is maybe forgetting words, getting things muddled up, but in terms of linguistics. What, interestingly, Donald Trump is doing, and there's been some like proper psychiatric analyses or psychological analyses of what he's saying, is he's confusing people. So Nikki Haley with Nancy Pelosi, and then continuing that. It wasn't like, oh, I got the name wrong, let's change it. It's like literally he transposed one person into another person's role. And he keeps doing that. And if you actually transcribe his speeches at the moment that he's making, they make no grammatical sense. He is unable to make cogent sense. And what happens is when he gets reported in newspapers, the journalists edit what he says so that when it's reported, it makes sense. But actually, Donald Trump is not making sense. And I've seen two analyses recently that say Joe Biden has an aging brain, Donald Trump has a demented brain. And there's some insiders that have recently been saying that he is in a different place than he was 8 years ago and 4 years ago, to the point where actually he's starting to not have any inhibitions and he's saying bonkers things more often. And in the recent, I think, fundraiser, he was saying things apparently that he should have been shut down, but he has no inhibition. So there's actually a better case that Donald Trump has a cognitive decline that's more significant than Biden.
With all due respect, I completely agree with you, okay? But if you're going to call what's good for the goose good for the gander, President Biden makes many mistakes, doesn't know what century he's in, turns around and shakes hands of people that are not there, relies completely on his team for direction, and should not be carrying the nuclear football and facing a battle against Vladimir Trump. That's easy. So what's good for the goose is good for the gander. We have two horrible candidates.
I would agree that just finally on that, I would say that he is not ideal because I think he is old and he's not too old, but his age is an issue. And I would much prefer two completely different candidates. But I think he's still able to do that. And his State of the Union address was absolutely fine, to the point where people accuse him of being on drugs. You're like, you can't have it both ways. But I just think it's better weak than evil. I think part of the problem with the appeasement approach, as you call it, is I really want to know, and I think history will tell us, but we won't know for a long time, who's really making the decisions in that administration? Because I'm fairly sure.
I completely agree.
Yeah, Biden probably isn't making these big calls. And I think it is someone like Jake Sullivan, but it's probably not him alone, right? It's not like one person's going to be, but it could be. I don't know, right? We don't know enough. But I think there is appeasement with it. No, not appeasement. There's anti-escalation within that administration. That is a huge problem.
May I ask you a question?
Yeah.
Okay, Jake Sullivan wasn't elected as the president of the United States. Neither was Barack Obama or whoever else they want to throw in there as making the decisions. Therein lies our issue.
But it's the same. This so man, in the 2016 to 2020 Trump tenure, he was pulled back from nuclear attacking Iran, basically.
This is not by the administration right now.
No. What I'm saying is his administration pulled him back. So in other words, when we do vote presidents in, it's always a team effort. Like, we always put the single people up as figureheads, but like it or not, and probably good thing is it's not just one person, because they don't have the brain power to be able to know about everything in the world. So you have experts all around them. And the question is, who is it in a Biden administration, in the same way as it would have been, who is it in a Trump administration that allowed X or Y or stopped X or Y? Who is it in a Biden administration that is stopping or that is being so anti-escalation? So that we have Lloyd Austin and Assistant Secretary Dr. Wallander yesterday saying, oh, we're concerned about hitting oil refineries. No, that's not the right rhetoric.
Exactly. Well, I'm supposed to be asking the questions, but I will jump in with my opinion on this one because I think it's an important one. And I think that thing about team is absolutely correct there. And I don't think Biden's age is an issue, because essentially he is going to farm out a lot of this stuff to his team, and they're going to come back to him. If he is comfortable with the answer, he'll go with it. So I don't think it's an age thing. And I think he does have time behind the scenes to think through those issues, and almost certainly has the cognitive ability to do it. The challenge here is the team that Jonathan described is exactly the same team that was in the Obama administration and created the reset with Russia. It's the same people. It's the same team. It's the same thinking. They're still thinking in normalization terms, that this is a bad scenario, but we have to manage it, and it will eventually end in negotiation. And they think of it in terms of a regional war, a regional problem, probably not even top of their agenda. They're not looking systemically at it, and they don't understand Russia. I think it's the team dynamic that's the real problem. So, of course, if we vote Biden in, we vote someone, and I think just focusing on his age can be quite distracting, because we don't then look at the systemic strategic problem that's clearly there. And if we vote Biden in, we're probably voting his team in. I mean,
which is what Greg was saying, to kind of agree with Greg where we can on this, is that you're not voting the team, you're voting Biden. But that's the reality of the situation. But you get the team. And if you don't know, and this is the same with every presidential election, it's nothing to do with this one in particular, but if you don't know who the team is, sometimes you're not really sure about what you're voting for, essentially.
Thank you. That's the point.
Yeah.
We don't know the team. We don't know who's pulling the strings. We can think, we can guess, we can offer conjecture, but yeah, that's a struggle. We're not voting for a team.
But that's the same for both sides, president, though.
I understand. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. We completely agree here, to be quite honest.
Yeah.
We need a new candidate.
Yeah. But what here, actually, something I did want to say earlier, and sorry to jump in again, Jonathan.
No.
But what I think would happen is, if Trump was invalidated from running, so say he got put in prison or something went wrong or whatever, if someone like Nikki Haley, I'm not saying particularly her, but someone like her jumped back in, I bet you would get such a sigh of relief from so many moderate Republicans because any far right Republican is always going to vote for the Republican candidate. So you don't need to worry about them. In a two party race, you don't need to worry about your extremes. You're only bothering about the center. So if someone like Nikki Haley came back in, you would actually get a romping, I think, where Republicans would win this. I don't think the Republicans can win with Donald Trump. That might be controversial, but all the trends are going that way. And I don't think Donald Trump will get in, ceteris paribus. So if everything remains as it is and nothing crazy happens, I think Biden gets in. But if the Republicans would win if someone else was running against Trump.
I completely agree with you. And I would even take it a step further. If Trump was disqualified and Haley came back, it would be a landslide.
Yeah, I honestly think it would. Well, I don't know about landslide, but it would be a fairly convincing victory, I think.
And another idea. Another idea I want to inject into the US political system is that if we do face a Trump-Biden standoff, if Biden were to show leadership, I mean, the videos that I do with General Ben Hodges and the comments that come up there show to me that there is a desperation for someone that shows leadership. I believe that if Biden was to show genuine leadership, sack his team very visibly, including Sullivan, and demonstrably come out and say, look, we've made a mistake here. Now we're going to go all in, defeat Putin, and this is what we're going to do, and this is how we're going to achieve victory. I think people on both sides are looking out for leadership. Those who've pinned their colors to the Trump mast interpret his words, actions, and forcefulness of leadership. I think none of us three do, but I think there's a definite desperation out there for people wanting a candidate that shows some kind of genuine leadership and strength.
I would highly respect deeply what you just described, and it would begin to persuade me that there is hope if something of that nature would happen. I hope that's a fair answer. The other thing that I would interject here, guys, and I do not know the numbers, and it would be interesting, JP and Jonathan, I don't know how to get these numbers, but there is a large portion of the American community that doesn't care. And yeah. I think many times we don't calculate that in. They just do not care.
Yeah, so I listen to an awful lot of political analyses, American political analyses, and they say, we care about, quite a lot, the good ones say, look, we think about this all day and every day, but there's such a large proportion of the American public that doesn't think about politics any of the days. And so therefore, and this is why Biden is actually gaining momentum a little bit now, is because people are actually seeing Biden. So the State of the Union, like, he hasn't been campaigning. Trump's always campaigning because he was on TV, and that's one of his strengths, right? But he's always there. And it's called the mere exposure effect. So the mere exposure effect is like how Coke works. You have Coke adverts on all the time, and you're going to get a drink, it's going to be Coke. You have someone on TV all the time. Who are you going to vote? The person you see on TV all time. Biden's suddenly coming back. He's basically been absent because he's actually running the country and governing stuff. But now he's in appearing, and there's lots of adverts. You're starting to see the polls shift. But those people that don't really care are actually the sort of people that advertising and coverage will appeal to somewhat, because they otherwise don't pick up on these things. But I would, just to your last point, Jonathan, I don't think Biden ever will get rid of anyone, because he's living in an information bubble, as we all kind of do. And in order to realize that these people are wrong, you need to take yourself out of that information bubble, because they're the ones that are providing you with all your information. So they're never going to provide you information that shows that they're plonkers, right? So in order to understand that, you need to somehow get a grasp on the effectiveness of these people. And you can only do that by being outside of that information bubble. So I just don't think that's ever going to happen, sadly.
This has been a very refreshing conversation. Seriously, we've covered a lot, and to be so different in some of our views, it's interesting how similar we are when we get down to some brass tacks. It's very encouraging. Thank you. Very encouraging.
And either way, I mean, absolutely stimulating, I think, and I think the audience will think the same. Whatever happens, whether Biden gets in, whether Trump gets in, whether we get more appeasement, delay, and incrementalism, or whether we get a candidate who will, I think, genuinely cut off all aid to Ukraine, and not just that, will actively collaborate with Putin to try and force Ukraine into an unenviable position. That's my view. But neither outcome is particularly good for Ukraine. Whatever happens, it seems that Europe really needs to step up, because there is not going to be a strong US strategy or action behind a Ukrainian victory. The only way to achieve it really is for Europe to come in force, take action, not dither and delay, and give Ukraine what it needs. That's a fairly big stretch there. Is that a fair conclusion? I mean, this is going to be the last question. Is this a fair conclusion for both of you?
I completely agree with you. And it's not only a fair question, I complete agreement. This is right now a precarious time where I think your description of appeasement or collaboration, that's what we're facing right now. And for me, neither one of those are the best option, of course. And I personally, I assume, like you guys, see this as a landmark moment in the history of the world, a landmark moment for my children, my grandchildren, the world as we know it. And yes, Europe does need to stand up, coming from an American, but at the same time, America needs to stand up as well.
I don't know that I'd term the Biden administration appeasement. I'd call them anti-escalation. And that might end up leading to appeasement eventually. But I think the important thing is, I think nuclear war is still this massive issue. Like, we wouldn't be having these discussions if there were no such things as nukes. Russia would have been absolutely destroyed by now. And any conventional, if there was only conventional warfare, NATO would have just gone, well, NATO wouldn't exist because they exist because of nukes. But it's all about nukes. And that is the card that the Russians hold. And that's what they hold over people like Jake Sullivan or whoever it is. So that's just one thing. But talking about the best outcome for me for the American election is, and I say this not because I favor Democrats, but actually from a practical point of view and how you get bills through Congress, is they need a Democrat trifecta. So you need the president, you need the House, you need the Senate, and you need the House of Representatives. Because if you have a split Congress, like you do at the moment, where the House of Representatives has a Republican majority of only one, you've got a single person, Mike Johnson, that can hold the whole process to ransom. And things don't happen. This has been one of the least productive sessions of Congress in history. And so just from the practicality of making laws or passing bills, you need a trifecta. So the Democrats, and since the Democrats seem to be more favorable generally, like it's only MAGA that's really holding things up for Republicans, but since the Democrats are more favorable to Ukraine generally across the party, I would favor a Democrat trifecta. Like, this is just considering only Ukraine and nothing else to do with American politics, right? So that's the main thing there. In terms of Europe, sorry, and answer a lot of answer here. I think Europe does need to stand up. I think Europe is standing up. But Greg and I have talked about this before. I think that possibly the threat of the missiles that is now hanging over Ukraine and this change in using KH-69s and Kinjal missiles that have destroyed. So a bunch of KH-69 missiles, this newest type of missile, has destroyed an entire power station in to the south of Kyiv. And if they can do that 2 nights ago, they can do it in 2 nights' time, and they can do it next week. And Ukraine are on a precipice at the moment, and they're very close to a complete energy collapse.
Right.
And in case something happens. And Greg and I have talked about before how sometimes a massive disaster is what you need to kickstart people into action. And perhaps a complete disaster for Ukraine, and I don't want that to happen. I'd love people to kick into action without needing a disaster, right? But perhaps a bit of a disaster for Ukraine could kickstart not only Europe even more. Actually, Europe has kickstarted, and I'm really happy with the way Europe are going, but it needs to all be just a bit quicker. And and the Ukrainian people themselves, the people over to the west in Lviv and so on and so forth, aren't feeling the heat of the war because they aren't experiencing living close to the front line. They might need a bit of a disaster to kick them into, like, oh, right, we need to volunteer to the army and solve that mobilization issue. So you could get a situation where disaster could be what catalyzes the required reaction.
And these are topics I think we pick up in the next one. And of course, escalation management, I think, will prove to be a disastrous failure, because not only is Russia taking out the energy infrastructure in Ukraine, Ukraine is poised to take out the oil infrastructure in Russia. And without US leverage, they could go after the ports, the pipelines, they could go after the crude extraction and transportation. This could get extremely messy, and it would be a terrible epitaph on the absolute failure of escalation management, almost certainly led within the Biden administration by Jake Sullivan. These are all topics I think we need to come back to, because the next couple of weeks are going to prove absolutely a critical time, as you both said. Thank you so much. This is incredibly stimulating. Try and get this out onto the channel today, because I know the audience will massively appreciate this, and hopefully it will generate a vigorous debate. Thank you so much for your time and sharing your insight, though.
Thank you very much, Jonathan. And thanks, Greg. And we've reached across the aisle yet again, my friend.
Absolutely, brother. Thank you, Jonathan. And thank you, JP. And agree with you, this will need a part two.
Slava Ukraini.
Erem Slava.